This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by Grand Seiko and the GHPG award-winning SLGH-005. Part of Grand Seiko's heritage collection, the SLGH-005 has a dial meant to invoke the graceful serenity of white birch. Please stay tuned for more information later in the show or visit grand-seiko.us.com for more. Hey, it's me, James Stacy, and in this surprise extra episode of Hodinkee Radio, we're discussing the latest action out of Geneva following this past week's massive kind of record-setting sales from Only Watch and a handful of the major players in the fall auction calendar. Joining me today in the fray is our EIC Jack Forster and our man on the front lines in Geneva, Logan Baker. Logan, what's the scene in Geneva today? And, you know, how tired are you?
I am...
What time is it in your brain?
I'm not sure if time exists anymore, but I don't think I'm the only one that feels that way.
Sure.
I know, James, you just got back from Germany, so starting to get back to that grind of international travel, which is a lot of fun. But even in Geneva, I think the vibe is people are starting to feel a little tired after the craziness of Friday and Saturday during the first sessions of Philips and at Only Watch, where we saw some really, really impressive, you know, numbers. I think things slowed up a bit on Sunday during session two of Philips and earlier today at Christie's Rare Watches. We'll get into that a bit more later, but I think that's kind of the vibe out here in Switzerland.
Yeah, so that is kind of the layout. And I wanted to have you guys on. Obviously, Jack, you have experience with kind of all of these things, both remotely and in person over the years. But Only Watch was huge this year. In many ways, it kind of feels like this whole idea of Only Watch has really hit like a zenith where everyone kind of understands. The brands that are involved are really turning out interesting, fun watches. And the response from people who want to get one of these really cool one-of-one watches and support a charity, everybody seems to be on board with the concept. And it's not something we get to do every year. So I definitely think it's worth some time. And then we'll definitely get to the auctions because there was some really crazy stuff. I mean, I've been saying pandemic pricing for a year, but maybe we're still seeing kind of the long tail of that effect. How about we start with Only Watch? You know, it was 53 watches. From a variety of brands. You're talking everything from, you know, Baltic all the way up to Audemars Piguet and Patek and things like this, and a lot of independents, which I think is why this can be kind of as interesting as it is. It's cool when a big brand with a lot of power flexes and makes some wild clock or whatever, but it's a little bit different when you get to deal with brands that you kind of know that for them to make it, they had to stop doing something else. And like, sure, it earned great money and everything, but it's not like a normal sale where like this is going towards something. And when you say towards something, 99% of the 29,740,000 CHF goes towards supporting Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So I think it's worth a chat. What do you guys think of this? What do you think of the success this year?
Well, I have to say, first of all, Luke Pedavino is one of my heroes in the business. The fact that he, you know, puts this thing together every year, has a personal stake in it, and is so completely selfless about the time, energy, and effort that he puts into organizing it is amazing. And I think that the degree to which the watch industry kind of like, especially the independents, you know, I mean, brands really, really do get behind supporting this. It's a really, really worthwhile cause. And we're at a time in research into therapies for Duchenne muscular dystrophy where we're actually getting to within spitting distance of effective therapies, and every single penny counts. So, you know, I mean, I take my hat off to them and to Only Watch and to all of the participants, because there is no single more worthwhile auction to support and to pay attention to, I think, in the entire calendar.
Yeah, agreed, Jack. This is the first time I had a chance to meet Luca Pedavino in person, and I was just flabbergasted by how kind he was. I mean, it really just kind of radiates out of him, and that's not always the vibe you get from random people you meet in Geneva. And so I was really, really impressed just out of kind of what he has created and how he really leads the organization and the whole auction with kindness in his heart. And, you know, this year, all the watches together reached 30 million Swiss francs, which I will note, the 2019 auction, the Patek Grandmaster Chime by itself reached a higher figure at 31, which I think is just interesting in itself, because that is obviously the most expensive amount ever paid for a watch at any one time. But all in, since 2005, with $30 million from this year, Only Watch has raised $100 million for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is just incredible. I mean, I can't think of another space in the watch industry where there is more good being done than Only Watch once every 2 years. And we also get to see some really interesting, incredible watches out of it that kind of can make or break trends for the next few years.
I mean, it's kind of fantastic, right? There's a lot of good being done, like a lot of good being done by an incredibly wonderful human being. And the watches are pretty fantastic.
Yeah. What ones kind of stood out for you? I think it's kind of fun because these are this theoretical thing. These are new watches. It's not vintage. We're not questioning the provenance of any of this. We're not looking into the histories or the claims or the conditions of the cases. It's just like, they're all new watches, but there's only ever going to be one. So you kind of are forced to either fully ignore it, which I don't think you can when you're talking about $100 million earned through this program, 100 million Swiss francs, it's $110 million. And then not even that, if you like watches, there's kind of something here for everyone. It doesn't really matter what your taste is. There's some really chill stuff. There's some really crazy stuff. My last night I was scrolling through this trying to prep for it. And my daughter saw the Bell & Ross concept skull watch. And she was like, do you have any skull watches? Because that's kind of cool. And I was like, no, I don't have any skull watches.
Speaking of that, Bell & Ross, I was incredibly impressed at its result. I mean, I think it was 220,000 Swiss francs. I was in the room and it was just, you know, nothing against that watch. But I was just looking around and just like, wow, this is... all it takes is two people, of course, to really bid a watch up. But I feel like that was kind of the vibe of the room. Everyone wanted something. And if the Bell & Ross Cyber Skull, you know, with the orange see-through sapphires, if that's the one you want, then you're going to go all the way to get it. 220,000 Swiss francs. Wow.
I mean, let's face it. Like, at a conceptual level, it's a really cool watch. And I get why my kid likes it. She has kind of wild tastes and stuff. And you know, maybe the strap is the part that I would ask Bell & Ross if they could get me a gray one or a black one or something like that, the white. But man, I think it's really cool. And then when you look the other side, it's kind of the architecture of that movement really suits being used in that format. There's an artistry to it. So I think you got to respect that.
I thought about this a lot before jumping on to record this, and I kind of have like three... It's a three-way tie for me between the Acrivia, the Constantin Chaikin, Mars Tourbillon, and the Crayon Everywhere. I mean, I think that they're really, really interesting watches from... Well, I mean, the Acrivia, first of all, is just like, if you like just like a drop-dead beautiful, absolutely drop-dead beautiful watch, like, you know, something where if you're like a watch enthusiast and somebody hands it to you, you're going to spend just like literally 6 hours staring at it, unable to say a word that is equal to the beauty of the watch. Like that's definitely it. You know, what's going to happen. That's definitely one of them. And I really dig what Constantin Chaikin is doing just because he's kind of a, like, I don't think that there are enough absolute lunatics in the business. And I mean, like, what kind of nutcase goes to the trouble of making a tourbillon that actually rotates once every Martian minute? I mean, that is the most absolutely insane thing that I've heard of, like, probably in the entire history of the tourbillon. Oh, we know the answer to that question. It's Constantin Chaikin. That's who's crazy enough to do that.
The other thing I would note is this isn't a brand that I pay a ton of attention to. They have a really good time, and I do really enjoy the Joker watches, but I say this a lot with a handful of brands. These are things you have to see in person if you can. Just for fun, even if you don't normally click on a Constantin Chaikin or a Joker watch or anything like that, check this one out in the show notes. It's a really, really good looking watch. It's super modern. The technical finishing is like adds a lot of drama to the piece without a lot of color. I think this is a very, very cool watch. And I think somebody did a really nice job in whatever it was that they paid for it. I'm sure it was an impressive amount.
It makes me wish that I were like a super wealthy James Bond villain so I could say things like, how do you like my Martian tourbillon, Mr. Bond? And then Crayon, I just...
Oh, the Crayon, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, doing sunrise, sunset complications that work anywhere on Earth, like, you know, within reason, I mean, not above the Arctic Circle and not too close to the equator, but, you know, I mean, it's something that nobody had ever done technically before. The engineering is amazing. The movement finishing is really, really good. And, you know, I mean, Logan, one of the predictions that you made was that this was a time to shine for independence, and I really feel like that was definitely true at Only Watch. I mean, a Martian tourbillon. Come on, man.
That's cool. That Crayon, that one's looking at just worth, just to see the back. the way that they finished it, where normally you have Geneva stripes that are, you know, they're equal and straight. And these kind of have a rippled effect, almost like a like after a stone hits a really flat surface of water. And it looks remarkable.
I want to second kind of everything Jack just said. I mean, if I had to pick three out of all 53 lots, the Krivia and the Constantine Chaikin would be up there for me. And I will toot my own horn for a moment and say that I kind of, in my Geneva Auction Week preview, I predicted that the Chaikin might kind of go the distance as a watch that was kind of underrated going in. And people, we might see it hit a really high number. And I believe it went 290,000 Swiss francs. So that's just phenomenal. And I had spoken with Chaikin over Zoom a few months ago for a story I was working on. And this was the first time I got to meet him in person. I mean, he's just like the most unassuming Russian, you know, man that you would never expect that all these kind of amazing creations have come out of his head. But he really is just a guy creating watches. Oh, and one thing that I learned, this is totally off topic, but back when the AHCI first got a Instagram, Constantine Chaikin was the guy that was running the Instagram and Facebook for the AHCI back in like 2010, 2011. So that's a little, I just find that incredible.
to that point, I mean, I don't think it is off topic. You look at something like a Krivia or Chaikin or Crayon, these are the lifeblood of what's happening in watchmaking right now. And they have a heart and soul for watches, whether that's taking part in something like this or helping the AHCI run their Instagram. it seems like a crazy thing to say, but I think it all adds up to the same kind of philosophy towards promoting watchmaking.
Yeah. And like, I mean, nobody makes a Martian tourbillon because they got a bunch of people together in a boardroom and focus grouped what kind of tourbillon would be like the best thing for them to make commercially. You make a Martian tourbillon because like you really want to make a Martian tourbillon.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And in speaking with him, you know, over the past few months when I've had the opportunity to, what's really become clear to me is that, you know, the Joker watches, the Wristmans, those have allowed him to really step up his game and kind of approach his technical watchmaking from an entirely new standard. I mean, the other Martian watch that came out earlier this year, I think it was the Martian Timer, that, you know, his ability to work on that is because of the commercial success of the Wristmans series. I mean, if I remember correctly, 80% of his revenue these days is generated by the Wristmans watches, which is, you know, the Joker, the Mouse King, all these different pieces, the Minotaur that just came out. And because people are so enamored with those, he's able to really approach kind of the high-end, super technical watchmaking that he is so passionate about and commercialize it and bring it to market, which is only good for the industry, independent watchmaking, for him. You know, I think that's fantastic. Whenever an independent can find something that, you know, will allow him to still work on like the things that he's really excited about, in addition to making a lot of money, like that's incredible. And I did just want to say the third only watch piece that really interested me would be the Jorn, and that was one that the Jorn Coppola complication, which the hand.
It's such a wild, I'm making a dumb hand thing into our Zoom call. It's such a crazy mechanism. Goodness.
Jack, James, and I all have our hands in the air right now. and that was one I have to say I wasn't incredibly enamored with at first, just seeing the renderings and whatnot. But as I started working on the story, you know, kind of the behind the scenes look at the watch that we published last week, where I was able to speak with both Mr. Coppola and Monsieur Jorn, and being able to see the watch in person to photograph it, it is really, really impressive. Like the watch in hand, the depth that Mr. Jorn was able to work out and the hand. I mean, the hand looks like a comic book or something. Like it looks straight out of some kind of artistic vision.
Like Iron Man or something.
Yeah, like Iron Man.
Like the hand to his suit or whatever.
Yeah, and the detail is just fantastic. I mean, all heat blued and it's all so thin. I mean, I can't remember the exact thinness, but it barely adds. It's this basic caliber, Jack. I think it's the 1320, the kind of flagship Jorn caliber. Is that right?
Automatic FFC octa caliber 1300.3 in 18K rose gold.
Okay, so it's 1300. That's the flagship Jorn caliber, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. And his goal was...
And not super thick. It's 42 millimeters by 10.70 millimeters.
Yeah, 10.7.
Super wearable. It's the size of a Seamaster.
His goal was to use the flagship Octa caliber, the 1300, without adding like a bunch of additional thickness, without having to add like an extra mainspring or anything like that to generate the power. So there's a system of four cams, which you can see on the lower right side of the watch. And those are literally what controls the kind of articulation, the upward and downward movement of each of the fingers. And then the fifth one for the thumb is not a cam, I believe. I would have to check my notes, but it, instead of like moving downward, it kind of swings in. So you'll notice it's slightly different than the four main fingers. The thumb kind of swings in.
Yeah, I watched a video on how to read it, and I don't remember anything from that video, so I'm not sure how to read it. But I'm sure you get used to that, or maybe you wouldn't wear one. Like, they paid a lot of money for it. I hope they wear it.
And that was literally Coppola's vision. Like, he was just like, "Hey, Jorn, like, has there ever been a watch that told time with a hand?" And Jorn was like, "What do you mean?
All watches,
of course, the watches have hands." Yeah, and so. Mr. Francis Ford Coppola was like, no. I mean, like, and he showed me on Zoom, he was just like, well, 1 o'clock would be like this, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. And he just like broke down the entire system of how that watch tells time, like over a glass of his own wine in 2012 with Jorn in Napa Valley. Just like, he just was like, "Hey, Jorn, like, this is how it would tell time." And Jorn was like, "That's interesting." And it took him...
let's give it a try.
Yeah, he was working on it in the background for a number of years. And, you know, kind of talking to Coppola off and on about like kind of the progress, what was happening. And eventually, Jorn told me about eight or so months ago, he had finally kind of was happy with where it was finished with it. Because he was never sure when he might be finished with it. So he got to the point where he was like, "Here we are, let's do it." And he was able to include it in Only Watch this year.
The other one I really like, which is not normally my speed, nor even a brand that I cover that or pay that much attention to, is that Jaeger Perregaux casquette that they made with Bamford. It reminds me of the MB&F Horological Machine number 5, which was, again, a watch where you kind of viewed it from one side. It kind of had a gauge pod from a car, kind of an automotive style. And this Jaeger Perregaux that they made with Bamford is forged carbon, which is, I have a huge love for it, like composite. Similar stuff that they use in a certain level of Lamborghinis. And it just has this texture to it that is really special when in sunlight and things like that. And it's just it's a really cool thing. And it kind of has a little bit of the bull of a Computron, like some pretty cool design there in a watch that I thought for not one of these ones that hit 6-7 figures, but still deeply cool thing.
The GP is based off an actual watch that they created in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah.
There is like vintage kind of inspiration there. And, you know, I think all these watches are inspired by, what was that Patek one-off prototype by the gentleman that invented the world timer?
Yeah, it was Gilbert Albert and Louis Cartier. And the date was 1958. And it is the reference 3414. And it was a weird-ass watch for Patek to produce in 1958.
We couldn't be more thrilled to have Grand Seiko supporting another episode of Hodinkee Radio with the new SLGH005 from their Heritage Collection. Sporting a steel bracelet and a 40mm steel case, the SLGH005 is a truly special watch that recently won the men's top prize at the 2021 Grand Prix de Horlogerie de Genève. Meant to invoke the look of the white birch that grow near the Grand Seiko studio where the watch is made, the SLGH005's textured dial glints in whites, silvers, and light grays with an astonishing effect. Tucked beneath that dial, we find Grand Seiko's latest high-beat 9S-A5 automatic movement, which ticks at 36,000 vibrations per hour while supporting 80 hours of power reserve and excellent daily accuracy. Plus, you can see it all through a gorgeous display case back. With a retail price of $9,100, the SLGH005 is a handsome, subtle, and special watch that draws inspiration from Japan's own natural beauty and the fine craftsmanship inherent to all Grand Seiko timepieces. Check the show notes for more or visit grand-seiko.us.com for more details. And now, back to the show. You know, the next one that really stood out to me, because I think it's kind of a special time for a different sort of kind of independent, more of a micro brand, is this performance of the Baltic hitting 50,000 Swiss francs. They've got to be just absolutely thrilled. At least I would be. So this is the Pulsometer Chronograph Mono Pusher. It's a really gorgeous kind of like deep mid-century, even pre-mid-century sort of design, big open case back. And a really beautiful watch. But I mean, let's face it, Baltic makes really beautiful watches for $800, $900 pretty frequently. You can probably, you know, get in line and get one today, but not this one.
Yeah, they used a 1940s Venus 150 movement for it.
Yeah, I think that has to be a record for kind of this era of internet-based, small, independent brands, you know, kind of what we formerly might have described as micro brands. I try not to use that term too much anymore, but, you know, congratulations, Etienne and team. I was texting with him briefly. You know, I think he's just ecstatic about how he's built up Baltic into kind of a really important player in the industry that's gotten sign-offs from, you know, John Goldberger, that people are, you know, he's doing really well for himself. And this has just solidified his position even further.
Yeah, no, it's an impressive thing. And then you eventually get to this really cool Octo QP, which sold for $220K with a tantalum case and a navy blue dial. And that also really speaks to me. Did you guys take a look at that one?
Yeah, it's a beautiful watch.
Yeah, super cool. You know, I was kind of watching that lot to see if it would be buoyed at all by its performance at the GPHG, where it won the Aiguille d'Or, which is basically, you know, the best picture prize, the best watch of the year. And, you know, it seems like it was. It's a beautiful watch on its own. Octo Finissimo, perpetual calendar, thinnest perpetual calendar in existence. You know, tantalum is just beautiful, you know, really kind of interesting weight to it. So I think whoever won that got it for a good price comparatively to everything else that was up for bidding. So congrats to the buyer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, for sure. And then the other one we've got on the list here, and Logan, it sounds like you've got a story. Maybe you're sitting right behind them. I will forever love De Batoon and Voutilainen, and to see them drop something together. And you knew it wasn't going to be anything other than really, really wild. This kind of encapsulates the best of what both of them do.
Well, I guess first I'll break down. This was the first only watch that I've had the pleasure of attending. And I have never been to a event where it felt like there was more kind of important players in the watch industry in one space, like not even Basel, not even SIHH, not Watches and Wonders, not GPHG just two nights before. I mean, this was an event where a lot of major brands were represented and they only brought their kind of seriously big name players. So like I look around and I see Laurent Ferrier, I see, you know, Max Buser sitting behind him, and they're not bringing their whole team of like PR comms people. There's just like one or two people per brand. And they're all wearing their like best watch ever. I mean, I was sitting behind, in addition to Kari, his daughter, Pierre Jacques from De Batoon, and one of his right-hand people. So I have never seen so much kind of like heavy-duty horological power in a single room. But to get on to the point of Kari and De Batoon, yeah, I mean, you could just sense that they were smiling at the results. I mean, I will admit up front that I thought the Recep Recepi Chronometrie Contemporain 2 was going to be the number two independent after the Jorn, but the Kari De Batoon collaboration ended up beating that, which, you know, I'm ecstatic for them. I was just surprised that they kind of flip-flop positions in that way. And yeah, they were just kind of like super happy. And after it reached the final price, they stood up from their seats and shook hands and kind of looked around and smiled while everyone applauded. And, you know, you really saw them kind of sink in just that their watch was worth that to someone worth over $1 million, that their collaboration achieved that for charity, that, you know, their names together can do that. Yeah. It's a big moment.
I was just saying a couple of complete powerhouses, and it's so nice to see people who have worked so hard to get to where they are and really tried to change the game for the last 20 years, and to see them be rewarded in this way and in a public way. That just sounds like a nice moment in the movie about that somebody might make about Only Watch or one of these brands someday.
Yeah. And on a similar note, I was, I could see Xavier, the CEO of Chopic, kind of across the room, perfectly mm-hmm. where from I was.
That sunrise is
beautiful,
gorgeous.
Beautiful. And the Rautrepont is super, super cool. They came out with the production version that famously sold out in a single hour at Geneva Watch Days. And I could see him when his watch came out, when the sunset came up for bid. And he was just had the biggest smile I have ever seen just the entire time. And when the bidding finally closed, he put two hands up in the air and was like, "Yeah!" You could just see how much it meant to him. And from a, like a lot of these independents look at this as a kind of branding moment as well. I mean, of course, it's amazing the watches, what it does for charity. But when they reach a particular price at Only Watch, it signifies strength in the brand as a whole and can lead them to maybe take more risks into the future. And it buoys the secondary market for those pieces. Only Watch can be kind of a linchpin of how an independent might perform in the next 2 years. I mean, we've seen it with Jorn over the past 5 years as his pieces have increased and increased in value. Of course, there's other elements at play, and it's not kind of a Bible for each brand, but I really think Only Watch is an opportunity for these independents to kind of set themselves up for the next 2 years in the public eye.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the other side of this is, it sounds like, and I'm reading between the lines only a little bit here, but like, you know, you go to these things, whether it's an industry auction or even some like industry large scale kind of presentation based events. I've not been to Only Watch, to be clear, but it sounds like this has a general like good vibe, excited, fun feeling. And a lot of them are like quiet, kind of tense. If you've ever been at an auction, and we'll get to some of these auctions, and you've been in the room, it really depends on who's running the auction. Sometimes they're fun. Arl does a really nice job like making it fun sometimes, or at least making jokes about people. So you kind of like, you're on your toes. Like, is he going to say something about me if I drop my pen or something like that? A lot of these can be kind of like somber, quiet. You know, the loudest sound you hear is somebody opening up a bottle of very room temperature Perrier.
Of 25 franc Coke Zero.
yes, again. But the big thing is not the money. It's the fact that it'll be warm. But yeah, but beyond that, it just sounds like fun to have this sort of thing happen. And it seems a little bit more lighthearted than some of these other things. And then when you see the results, you realize not only are they not messing around, maybe they're suggesting that we should all be having more fun than maybe we are otherwise, like without this sort of impetus.
I mean, I think Logan made an excellent point a couple of minutes ago about Only Watch being a place for independents to shine and for it being a place where they can really leverage exposure into, greater financial viability for their brand, greater visibility. It's a great marketing move or a great marketing event if you have a good result for a watch at Only Watch and you're an independent. But like, I'm wondering, you know, I'm this is going back to the story that you published earlier this week, Logan, about, you know, your predictions about the auction season. Like, do you think that the pendulum is going to swing back a little bit in terms of higher results, a little bit away from some of the blue chip brand name driven stuff that we've been seeing so much of over the last few years? And people are going to start going to the independents because, like, I mean, you know, beyond a certain point, you know, $2 million, $3 million, $4 million for like rare Pateks, rare Rolexes, you know, what have you. I mean, that can get like a little monotonous almost.
Definitely desensitized at this point. Like, I was, you know, scrolling through some of the results that we'll talk about in a few minutes here and just kind of like, how do I tell if this is special or if it's just kind of like last time?
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, you know, it's always dicey with the independents because you don't know. I mean, are they going to be around in 10 years? Am I buying something that is impressing me just because of novelty value? But I really feel like Logan was onto something with that. I mean, well, in general with that story, but with that prediction in general, because like, I remember when the first big wave of independent watchmaking in the early 2000s came through and, you know, I mean, there was just like jaw dropping stuff every 5 seconds, like, okay, half the stuff didn't work, but it was like, you know, but it was just amazing to see, you know, people making an effort. And like, I don't know, maybe people are looking for like a little bit more sort of real creativity and like real authentic watchmaking content.
I think you're absolutely right, Jack. And, you know, for me personally, the independents have always been an area where I find a tremendous amount of intellectual interest in. I have never been necessarily drawn to kind of the realm of vintage Rolex or Patek scholarship. I find it interesting and, you know, I try to learn as much as I can. But because I entered the watch industry as kind of from studying journalism and kind of falling into it rather than, you know, being interested because my dad gave me a Rolex or, you know, I my grandfather had a Patek or something like that, I was immediately drawn more to kind of the story that these living kind of legends were telling. So I am incredibly happy that there is so much more interest today than when I first entered the industry, you know, 5-6 years ago. But I also worry because, like you said, in the kind of early mid 2000s, there was a similar boom of interest in what independent watchmaking and that kind of creativity could do. But I feel like there was almost a glut that came from that period. And there were a lot of brands being created that shouldn't necessarily have existed. And then when the financial crisis happened, a lot of these brands got caught out in the cold. And some brands that shouldn't have been lost were lost because of that, because there was kind of an overabundance. So I encourage people to, over the next few years, to kind of really think strategically about why you're interested in supporting an independent, why you're interested in kind of supporting the work of someone who's living and creating art based on and engineering, and just really kind of figure out what you want to support, and don't get caught up in the hype, because the hype can drown away the fortunes of many when things turn the other way. So I hope that kind of answers your question, James and Jack, in multiple different ways.
Absolutely.
I agree with you 100%. And the other point that I think that's worth making, and this is probably like a whole separate episode of the podcast, but you know, independent watchmaking is not a singular thing, right? Like Philippe Dufour is an independent watchmaker. Constantine Chaikin is an independent watchmaker. If you want to really, you know, be literal about the definition, Audemars Piguet is an independent watchmaker, still run by members of the founding family. Rolex is an independent watchmaker. Patek Philippe is an independent watchmaker. You know, so when we're talking about independent watchmaking, I think we haven't put a strict definition around it as a community, and I kind of feel like we shouldn't. But like, if you say independent watchmaking, like you don't think of AP, which is a $1 billion company. You don't think of Rolex, which is a God knows how many billions company. You know, you think of individual creators and individual craftsmen expressing their particular singular vision of what horology is. And to me, that's the thing that like somebody like Constantine Chaikin has in common with Philippe Dufour. I mean, they're both stubbornly insistent on making their work an actualization of their particular vision of what watchmaking should be.
You know, I think an interesting way to look at it is, so we have F.P. Journe, Roman Gauthier, and Bell & Ross. Three brands all have investments from Chanel, which is great. You know, they can support these brands in the long term as well as the short term. But we only look at two as independent, even though technically they are all invested in by a big player named Chanel. The one that we don't think of as independent necessarily is Bell & Ross. And it's not because they're not independent. It's just because, you know, we think of them as more kind of a mass production business, I would say. So I agree, we don't necessarily need to put a label. There should be a general understanding of what kind of the independent and watchmaking means, whether it's involving handcraft or kind of a living person in charge of it. You know, I think it is probably an evolving definition that we'll see kind of change in a number of ways in the next few decades.
Yeah, I mean, and does having an investor like Chanel as opposed to an anonymous angel investor who maybe nobody ever hears about, like, does that make you a less independent brand? Like, I'm asking the question because I really don't know.
For me, and at least in my mind, it comes down to how many disconnections could I draw between the person at the top and the product? If it's like one or two people, that feels very independent to me. It's like, I think in other worlds, you'd call this a cottage industry. And I mean, to be clear, there's cottage industry supercars now. Like Rimac now just owns part of Bugatti. So these people have a lot of power in other worlds as well. So I don't think it's a weird thing that, Logan, I think that's a really beautiful example you just made and hugely accurate into how people perceive Bell & Ross. Versus maybe a different brand that doesn't make as many watches or have as many ads in various places. And I think it at a certain point, it is one of these terms kind of like micro brand, kind of like independent, and in many ways like in-house, that's almost useless. You have to look at things for what they are and either try and make further little slices or just see it as its own sort of thing. On the other flip side, I mean, not independent or not independent, but on the larger player side, we can't move on to the auctions without recognizing Tudor, the kings of only watch in many ways. I'm not saying the highest value, but we're still talking about $650,000. Again, that's 710 today USD for the Black Bay GMT1. An amazing result, a really cool watch. And it's not the first time that they've taken a perceived estimate. I think estimates are something we should all just start to ignore. They should stop putting them in auctions, but it take a perceived estimate. And then like we're talking orders of magnitude.
Yeah, that was nuts. That was absolutely nuts.
Really, really cool.
My my understanding of the kind of crazy prices that Tudor has achieved at auction is, you know, there's a gentleman, he's Philippe Dufour's business partner, Claude Sphere. He is the gentleman who kind of goes all in on the Tudor pieces, and he wants to own each one of those. So it explains part of the reason why they get bid up so high. And I think it's kind of cool that there is, he wants to have all these unique tutors. I remember at one point, Raul, the auctioneer, was like, Claude, let someone else win this one. He, people listening that might be hearing that name for the first time. I mean, he is one of the world's most important, like publicly known collectors. I think that's a fair description. He's a big deal.
All right. So we want to make sure we get to the kind of normal big fall auctions, Phillips, Christie's, et cetera. And we'll get there in just a moment. But before we leave, any other final thoughts from this one, Logan? I think it sounds like you had a decent time being able to witness it and be around both the people and these cool watches.
Oh yeah. Fantastic time. I mean, I just, there's two or three other kind of inside baseball notes, God, cringe that I just said it that way, but things that I want to remark on before we move on. And it's the 15202. It hit 3.1 million Swiss francs. That would have been a record for a Royal Oak at auction, if not for the Black Panther Royal Oak concept unique piece that was auctioned off earlier this year, which, is interesting. And I also would like to remark on that watch that AP, engraved unique piece, not only watch on the kind of on the case back, which take it how you want, but most people put only watch on the case back. So
yeah, that's right.
No, yeah, it's interesting. And then on the Romain Gauthier, I was able to speak with Romain after the auction. Personally, I'm like a Romain Gauthier fanboy. I adore his work. I think he's one of the most interesting and persuasive watchmakers working today. I was able to handle the serial production version of the Continuum that was announced a few weeks after the Only Watch collaboration came out. It is remarkable. I mean, it's 55 grams, $37,000. It's lighter than the Omega Ultralight, more affordable than the Omega Ultralight. Titanium bridges finished to the most fantastic degree that all his watches are. Just a really brilliant piece. And like you said earlier, James, I think that the way he handled the rainbow on the dial, very beautiful on the Only Watch one. And he told me that his order book is closed on the serial production piece for the time being. He had 120 orders in the first week. So that's
good for them.
That's incredible to hear. Very happy about that. And I think it's worth noting that there was the only Richemont brand present during Only Watch was Montblanc with a Nicolas Riosec piece. I'm not quite sure why that is. I believe they've participated in previous auctions in a more prominent way. So I just kind of wanted to flag that. And then out of all the LVMH watch brands, Zenith had the best performance, only almost hitting half a million Swiss francs. It was a collaboration with Felipe Pantone, the artist. It came with a big piece of Mr. Pantone's art. Really, really beautiful. But I have to say, impressed that it topped both the Tag Heuer Monaco Carbon in that crazy Hublot Sapphire piece. Good for Zenith. I was sitting with the Zenith people and Julian, the CEO. Everyone was ecstatic, topped off a great week for them. But I think that's worth noting that they performed the best out of all four LVMH brands and kind of puts an emphasis on the hot streak that brand is on in 2021.
Absolutely. I think that's a very fair flag for sure. Look, I want to make sure that we can get into some of the auctions. We're going to bounce back and forth, but let's start with Phillips. First of all, just to make it clear, everything we're going to talk about, just so that's a little bit faster, we're talking CHF. I didn't do the conversion on all of these. It's a 1.1 currently, if you want to go to USD. I looked at this and the first thing that leapt to my mind is it's pretty clear that the ship has sailed on me someday getting a 5164A. I think I have to admit I missed my chance. I think one went for the better part of 90. And it's, I guess I'll just be kicking myself, but let's face it, 90K from a watch at this auction would be a drop in the bucket. Logan, where would you start? What was it like in the room?
Yeah. I think we should start at the Speedmaster, the 2915 with the tropical dial.
The capital T for
yeah.
sure.
That was the lot.
Good for Omega.
That really kind of, I think, made the weekend for me. It was the lot where I felt like I was watching history being made. I mean, it's for the record, that's the most expensive price paid for a Omega watch at auction. It was remarkable just the way that the bidding kept going up. I mean, everyone in the room, I was sitting in the press section, was just like, we were looking at each other like, what the hell is going on? I legitimately felt lightheaded. I wasn't timing it. I had a chronograph on. I should have. But Yeah, I think it probably took 15 minutes because it was just like this back and forth where things would pause for a moment while, you know, the phone bidders are on the phone with the people they're representing. Mm-hmm. RL is doing his thing, you know, kind of, I don't want to say hamming it up, but, you know, he is kind of putting on a show to a certain degree. And
he understands the fact that it's way more fun to watch when he's having
exactly.
a good time.
Yeah,
I'm 100% a huge fan of the way that the guy runs 100%. An auction.
I mean, it's as much a show as it is a anything else. He's the best.
Well, because I think they have some understanding that there's people watching at home. There's people watching who are watching because something like this might happen.
Yeah,
and it's not just buyers who are there to make a transaction. I'm not buying anything, but I'm still here for it. You know,
the comparison that I would make to Geneva Auction Week after attending it for the first time is, in a lot of ways, it's similar to the MLB playoffs, where the rest of the auction season is the regular season. And then you get to Geneva Auction Week, where kind of all the heavy hitters come out, from the watches to the auction houses to the collectors. You know, they kind of all descend. And just like there's kind of extended pitch counts, and the games take, you know, 3 or 4 times longer than they do in the regular season. The auctions take much longer. Mm-hmm. I mean, both sessions of Phillips took over 6 hours each.
It was a lot of lots, to be fair.
Yeah, 249 lots altogether, split into, you know, 125 or so on Friday, 125 on Sunday. But Friday was over 6 hours. Sunday was right around 6 hours. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, it's it's a rare reference, but boy, oh boy, that was $3 million is a lot of money. I mean, obviously.
And then we've got two Dufours that went for more. So we didn't start with the top lot. We've got the Duality went for 3.6, and then the more complicated one, the Grand Petit Sonnery, went for 4.75. Dufour's got to feel pretty good, let alone the guy who gets to take that watch home. Some pretty beautiful stuff for sure. That's got to be coming pretty close for a record, right? You've got to be at least within shooting distance, right?
So this is something Jack and I have been DMing pretty furiously about over the past 48 to 72 hours, because we were trying to figure out what actually was the record for a, you know, independent maker at auction for a timepiece. In 2019, we saw the George Daniel Space Traveler 1, I believe it was, kind of set a new record. And we determined that the F.P. Journe Francis Ford Coppola FFC Blue for Only Watch 2021 set the record at 4.5 million Swiss francs, because there was no auction premium included. The Dufour Grande Petite Sonnery hammered at 3.9 million Swiss francs, I believe. With auction premium, it hit 4.75 million Swiss francs. How do you compare?
Oh, that's a premium, man.
How do you compare? Yeah, that's, you know, just an extra million, you know.
That's a lot of money.
Extra million cheddar on top, just a little bit. Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah, that's a lot of sauce.
But so how do you compare a auction that has no premium, Only Watch, to an auction with premium?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one way you could look at it is, whether or not the auction, I mean, auctions almost always involve a buyer's premium, right? I mean, Only Watch is a major, major exception. And, you know, certainly to the person who paid $4 million in change for the Dufour, you know, they're not saying to themselves, yeah, but, well, I really only paid $3 million in change because after all, the buyer's premium is an abstraction that doesn't affect the size of the check I had to write, but like it affects the size of the check you have to write. So, I mean, if you're the proud owner of the Dufour Grande Petite Sonnerie and you paid, $4 million plus for it, and you want to go around saying that you own the watch that set a world's record for a price paid for an independent. Well, yeah, you paid that price. And it is, in fact, the highest price all in that anyone's ever paid for a watch from an independent watchmaker, not counting Rolex, Patek Philippe, Audemars Piguet, you know, all the guys we decided don't count because of our purely arbitrary classification of what an independent watchmaker is. But, you know, I mean, just like circling back around to, the point is, yeah. somebody had to cut a pretty big check for that watch. Yeah, and
sure. Now, I think that record is crucial. I think it's important. I think it's something worth considering and monitoring as these prices continue to do what they're doing. But I do want to know, is this the most ever paid for a watch box at auction? It's a Journe that went for 100,800 Swiss francs.
I mean, Aurel was kind of riffing on it during the auction. He was like, is this a record for a box? He was like literally asking people in the room, is this a record for a box? I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's a record for a box.
If I borrow Logan's sports analogy with the major league. Like it, like if you went to basketball, this is the Globetrotters coming in at halftime.
Oh my God.
Like this is a, this is just completely. Yeah, so,
this is the extra mustard.
So crazy.
Extra mustard.
Someone paid $100. No, no, didn't come with any watches. I'm sure it's a perfectly lovely watch box. Let's be clear. I have nothing against the product that somebody's buying, but it's still $100,000 for a watch, a five watch box from Jorn.
Well, yeah, to be clear, so there were five Jorn subscription pieces, all number one of their series that were available from Philips, all came from the same collector. The collector had a specific...
That really bummed me out, man. Like, they broke up the band.
Yeah, they broke up the band, yeah.
They broke up the band.
RL is Yoko Ono, you know, so...
Right, right. in this scenario,
yes. Five watches.
So... This collector had a box made by F.P. Jorn in Geneva to hold all five watches. And it said, you know, subscription piece number one on it. So, you know, it's not just any box, but it's also a box.
Okay. So beyond a very impressive result for a box that now no longer has the five watches in it that it was made for.
Not one, but two Rolex Deep Seas that did not hammer for their low estimate.
That's true. Yep. So yeah, we can get into these two Deep Seas. The Deep Seas kind of come in two varieties. It's these commemorative editions, which were made later on following the success of the Trieste mission to the bottom of Challenger Deep, you know, to get to the bottom of the ocean or the then known bottom of the ocean, and ones that were involved in the actual production of that mission. And there were several prototypes in there. And so they kind of come in two varieties. And I think we saw that play out in the pricing here, where the Philips piece, which was a commemorative edition. So this would be something for museums, you know, Rolex promotional events and maybe really good retailers. Some of these were sold without movements. They're all kind of different things. And they weren't strictly watches. They weren't necessarily, you know, water tested to the bottom of the ocean, some 10,908 meters. That one went for just a hair over $1 million Swiss francs with your buyer's premium, 1.058. And then Christie's has one that's purportedly used to test various depths, prototype fashion, before the final dive that would eventually make it to the bottom. And in that case, theirs went for 1.89 million on 2 to 4 million in estimate. And in my mind, these prices kind of make sense because these aren't like watches you would wear. These are more like museum pieces, more like cool things to collect. You know, the one that actually made it to the bottom of Challenger Deep, that's at the Smithsonian. You know, we've seen Rene Baer on Talking Watches. He has one at his museum. So I think these are more museum pieces. And I wasn't sure if maybe what we're seeing is we thought now was a good time to sell something like this due to kind of pandemic pricing. But that pricing doesn't necessarily go to fairly niche objects. Logan, do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, it takes a really... And I talked with a few people in the room, including... you know, John Goldberger and a few other people, just to kind of get their vibe on what I saw as disappointing results. I mean, neither hit their low estimate. And it really takes a specific collector. And it's more likely that, you know, someone who is fascinated with submersibles and really interested in that kind of thing would have more of an interest in these watches than a watch collector would.
You're definitely not buying one of those because it's a wonderful classic example of mid-century watch design.
No, it's a very specific thing.
Esoterica
to the, you know, highest degree. I don't know. It's cool. The story is cool. I think it's just difficult to find the right client for it.
Yeah. And the values are that's a good increase in value since the last time we saw these sure. sorts of watches hit the auction. So it's not like they're decaying or we're seeing a big fall off. I just think like maybe the hype wasn't as high as people thought or the stoke, if that's an easier expression for kind of an in-room buying sense.
Yeah. And I think it's also like, obviously it's going to be like everyone knew it was going to be super expensive. So, you know, the dudes with the biggest pockets were probably like, I'd rather spend $3 million on a Jorn than $1.5 million on a Deep Sea Special. And then, you know, what else I could buy for $1.5 million. Jesus, I can't believe I'm talking about this type of money, y'all.
Yeah, and it could be that these one that we're what we're seeing is kind of the peak of what these are worth. Whereas I think it's as crazy as this sounds, I think we may see that these Jorns, you know, these subscription ones, which did go for 3, 4, 5, a lot of value. There might be room to grow still left there, so people might have seen more of an investment ability or a perceived upside than being the next sort of custodian to a museum piece.
Yeah, I mean, there were hundreds of high value watches that went under the hammer over a 4-day period, I mean, hundreds of them. And there's not that many people in the world who are willing to spend 7 figures on a collectible wristwatch. I mean, there's definitely enough to keep, you know, that many auctions going and produce some record results. But I think you're probably right, James. I think there were probably some, you know, serious collectors with very deep pockets who were keeping their powder dry for other stuff. Yeah.
It would make sense to me. You know, if you just do a casual scroll through the feed, and I think this works for Phillips or Christie's, the tenants remain strong. Steel Rolex is strong. Gold seems to be growing in value. We're seeing a continued success of Cartier, Daytonas. It seems like any Daytona, weird Daytona, sure, good value, kind of classic Daytona, still crazy valuable. So I think that the tenants are still the kind of bedrock of what these high values are based on. The blue chips are still working. So I don't think we're going to see some major collapse in between, say, this year and say next November. But yeah, I don't, you know, the thing is we've been going for a little while here. We'll have a bunch of stuff on the site covering this story and more. And if we get more angles on it, we'll do another episode for sure. With the last few minutes that we've got here, if you guys still have a couple minutes left, let's chat a little bit about GPHG because Logan, you attended. Jack, you've been involved, I think, several years in one capacity or another.
Yes, I was a member of the on-site jury for 3 years and I'm a member of the Academy now. So what happened was they basically restructured the way that the voting is handled in order to get input from a larger number of people and also to produce, I think, a greater sense among people who follow the GPHG results that what you're really seeing is a consensus among a large number of watch experts. So it moved from being a small group of people in a closed room, holding a private conversation under the, which I kind of liked, I have to admit, to being something where there's a larger voting committee. And then there's still a smaller group that meets in person in Geneva. And the voting is weighted so that the people who are actually there on site and are part of that group, their votes are more heavily weighted than the votes from the Academy.
I want to be upfront and say that because a few people after I wrote my kind of recap article said that I was bitter because I wasn't on the jury or something like that. I actually really like the GPHG. I think the watch industry needs an award show. I think it's an awesome time to bring people together. I genuinely care about what the GPHG represents for the industry as a whole. I think it's interesting that it's supported by the Canton of Geneva. I mean, this is some super Swiss stuff here, which I think is really fun as an outsider. And because I care, you know, I think that it's important to understand that it could be better. It could be much better. I mean, how can you say that this is the best watch of the year? And if, you know, if Patek isn't there, if no Swatch Group brands are there, if, you know, if FP Journe isn't there, if Rolex isn't there. And that's through no fault of the GPHG by itself. It's just, we need a way to determine this kind of thing that represents the best interests of the brands, of the media, of, you know, the collectors, of the casual enthusiasts, because it's a powerful, powerful marketing tool. I mean, in my stories, because I pay attention to the GPHG, if I'm writing about something that won the Aiguille d'Or 5 years later, you know, I mentioned that it was a previous Aiguille d'Or winner. You know, I'll probably, the next 5 Octo Finissimo stories I write, I'll be like, oh yeah, they won the Aiguille d'Or this year. It is an important moment.
It definitely doesn't mean nothing. I mean, you know, it is an important moment, and the awards are meaningful. They're just meaningful. You have to take them within the context of how the GPHG overall is organized. And you know, when you do that, you're in a better position to sort of evaluate what it means to you personally or what it doesn't mean to you. I mean, one of the things, this is getting back to you being the standard bearer for independent watchmaking at Hodinkee. Logan, it's not a bad thing to be, especially nowadays. One of the cool things about it is that because so many sort of like obvious, huge, you know, major commercially important brands, you know, don't participate, it does provide a showcase for independent watchmaking, for smaller brands, for brands that might find themselves, outshone if companies like Rolex and Omega did participate.
I don't remember if they used this term or if this term was thrown around because I wrote a story when they changed the format 2 years ago, maybe. If it was something that I said or they said, so my apologies either way. It was compared to it now that, you know, they want to make it more like the Oscar where you have this big pool of people bringing things in. But the point of the Oscars, conceivably, again, the background behind the Oscars is not a fair game either. And it doesn't include everyone. You can be iced out. You can be a day out of alignment. You can not have the budget to kind of bring everybody up to speed on your film. And sometimes you get lucky with a smaller film. You know, you think about something like Hurt Locker a few years ago, Catherine Bigelow. And then other times you have these years where like no one can rationally tell me what happened in 2011 when The Artist won over Midnight in Paris and Moneyball and War Horse and The Descendants and Extremely Loud. And like, I can do this a lot. I have a real thing for the Oscars, or not a thing, depending on how you want to look at it. But I do think that it would be crucial to have something like this in the watch game that felt like there was an award that could, that anyone could conceivably win. You definitely don't want a show where it's always Rolex and Patek and AP, but you also don't really want a show where they're not around and we're only looking at a slice of it. So if this is a growing, if the GPHD is growing and continuing to do good work, and I don't really mind that brands have to pay to be part of it. It costs a lot of money to put something like this on. As long as that's in the open, like you have no idea what most people spend to have their movie in consideration for a best picture. And then once they're told they're in consideration, then you bring out the other credit cards. Like, it's a very expensive process. So that, I don't think that's the problem here. It's the scope. It's a perspective thing. And if you guys figure it's growing, then I don't think any of this is bad necessarily. It just maybe hasn't gotten to where it needs to get to.
I think I certainly think expanding the Academy to include more voters was the right move. I mean, you know, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, it just felt like such an insider's game when there was like 20 or 25 yeah. of us. I mean, you know, again.
I mean, to be fair, they lost my email, but I don't disagree for sure.
I had a great time for 3 years being part of what felt like a super exclusive club. But, you know, the reality yeah. is it did reduce significantly the perceived relevance of the GPHG, and having more voters, you know, it helps. And to their credit, I have to say, they're completely transparent about it.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, anybody who wants to can go to the GPHG website and they can read what the criteria for entry are. I mean, there's no, people love to accuse the GPHG of, sort of behind the scenes shenanigans, but like, it's a pretty straightforward process. And of course, there's always politics involved. You know, people tend to vote for brands they like that are run by people they like. And, you know, I mean, that's the way these things work. I'm sure it's the way the Academy Awards work too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes like 2015, Spotlight wins instead of, you know, Revenant, Room, Mad Max Fury Road, The Big Short. To all four of those?
That's right. That's right.
Oh my goodness. It's a fantastic movie. I don't think it deserved that award. I guess this is arguably our point. You're not going to have consensus, and that's what makes it an award at a certain level, right?
Yes, and I think that's important. And I think people in the watch industry get uptight about the GPHG when people say it doesn't matter because, you know, they're part of the watch industry. But people argue about the Oscars and the Grammys, its relevance, the winners every single day of the week.
Forever.
And it's a sign of the GPHG actually mattering that people say it doesn't matter.
I think what people are saying is it doesn't matter in the way they want it to. So it's not reflecting the way that some people interface with the watch industry, in that they're not seeing all the brands and they're not seeing the watches that they absolutely love that they've been obsessing out over the last year.
So here's the thing, like the GPHG is never going to represent, there's never going to be a one-to-one correspondence between who wins the awards and where the commercial center of gravity for the industry is. But that's not the purpose of the GPHG. The purpose of the GPHG is not to hand out, the biggest and most interesting awards to the brands that make the most money every year. You know, and I think, and honestly, I would rather have them doing what they're doing, which is, you know, foreground kind of interesting, unusual watchmaking from brands that you don't necessarily hear that much about, and have some, you know, some of the bigger brands that are taking some risks come in. Like, you know, I mean, I love the fact that Bulgari participates. I think that it's a very on brand for them to do so, given the risks that they've been taking in watch design and in technical watchmaking over the last few years. But like, yeah, it's not supposed to be an automated system for handing out brass rings to the companies with the biggest turnover. It's just not.
I don't know. This is going to sound negative, but you know, I would love kind of to have a better understanding of kind of the jury's knowledge base and how they approach each auction. And I don't mean the jury as in like the Academy as a whole. Like, I want everyone to be vetted and to have a full understanding of each category to be active in the watch industry, to be active in understanding and contextualizing what each watch and what each brand is trying to achieve. Because if you have to, it can't just be like, this watch looks cool. I think you really need to contextualize what this brand is trying to do with this watch.
How successful is this?
Yes. How successful is this watch and what is it trying to be? To use the diver category as an example, I'm fine with a Louis Vuitton watch winning because it is a more aesthetically interesting take on a dive watch in 2021 than the Oris necessarily. But the Oris in itself as a product is a far bigger risk for a company to release. And from a kind of specs top to bottom category, you know, it is a more compelling nominee for me than the Louis Vuitton. I'm not saying the Oris should have won over the Louis Vuitton. I mean, yes, I'll say outright, I would have voted for the Oris over the Louis Vuitton Tambour Street Diver.
You can say that.
Yeah, I'll say that. Someone raised a good point in the comments that the dive watch category isn't a new movement category, which is a fair kind of criticism. But, you know, that kind of goes back to the point. Am I saying that the Oris Aqueous Calibre 400 should win because it has a better movement or because it's more successful at being a dive watch? Or because it's more successful at being a product, a novelty with the new movement. Other people, like I talked to a juror who said that he voted for the LV over the Oris because it was just another Oris Aqueous. And that's all it looked like, you know? That's a fair criticism. It looks like just another Oris Aqueous. So of course, this juror was more kind of drawn toward the exciting aesthetics of the Louis Vuitton, which is in itself a sweet watch.
It's a legitimate reason to like a watch. I mean, but this is to your point, Logan. You know, different people are going to evaluate different watches based on different criteria and different personal preferences, right? So like, okay, we've got this dive watch category and we've got a watch that's interesting from a design standpoint and atypical from a design standpoint versus one that looks like a very sort of like standard issue dive watch, like what you think of when you close your eyes and think of a dive watch, but it's got an interesting new technical movement in it that represented, you know, a real financial risk for the company and, you know, like however many years of development. So like, which one do you go for? I mean, do you go for the one that's more interesting from a design standpoint, or do you go from the one that you think represents, you know, the most integrity as a functional dive watch? And like, I mean, who's right in a situation like that?
Of these ones, definitely the Oris would have had my vote for sure. That seems easy to me. I think it's a very successful and down the middle, like a dive watch is a genre film, which of course wouldn't make it to the Oscars, probably why Heat didn't.
The winner of the Aiguille d'Or, which we alluded to earlier, was the Bulgari Octofinissimo Perpetual Calendar. World record for thinnest perpetual calendar, brand new introduction that came out at Watches and Wonders earlier this year, back in, I want to say, April or so. You know, brilliant piece. I will say I didn't necessarily expect it to win the Aiguille d'Or. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't find that terribly surprising, honestly. I mean, Logan, did you have something else in mind that you thought was a stronger contender, or like what made it a surprise to you?
I had as my dark horse pick the Bernard Lederer Central Impulse Chronometer, because I know that the GPHG likes to kind of throw a lot of respect toward indies. I thought it would be a cool moment to make to solidify the GPHG as a kingmaker to a certain extent, to really get the hype up for a certain kind of young independent that's iterating on its inaugural watch. I will say that it did end up winning the Innovation Prize. And it was also nominated last year with a kind of prototype unfinished dial. I think that was a mistake on Lederer's part. I think he should have saved it for this year when he had the kind of totally finished design. I thought that MB&F LMX had a chance.
Yeah, that would have been the one I would have leaned on. I understand picking the Octo because it is something genuinely special. And if we're talking about something that's very successful in the goals that it laid out, I think it is hyper successful. I mean, it's a very distinctive thing. It has a uniqueness that Bulgari brings to the table, but you're not going to discredit an MB&F for not being unique, a pretty special thing. And the truth is you can argue about the kind of need for an award show, which I think we do need it. It could be very entertaining. And I think that this show has been growing and is moving in a good direction. And I just hope that more brands, you know, start to participate and we see it kind of grow in the scope so that we have, it's nice when the movie or the watch that you like is on the list. Even if it doesn't win, it kind of gives you that connection. It's like when your team is in the playoffs, I guess, if we're going to continue the sports thing. The GPHD is out there at least attempting it. And I think that the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that people wanted to DM about LV versus Doxa versus Oris in my case, or I'm sure you guys got your own spread. And Logan, I'm sure you had 1,000 of these conversations in Geneva. I think that's where we can leave it for this show. Guys, it's been an absolute treat to see you both. Logan, I hope you're able to make it home and get some rest and enjoy a weekend. without people swinging hammers or spending seven figure sums around you. Thank you both so much for being on the show.
Thank you, James. Always a pleasure and great talking, Logan, and a safe trip home.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it. See you soon.
Yeah, for sure. And if you're enjoying the show, like I said, please tell a friend. If there's something you think we missed, and with a show like this, it was a lot, drop it in the show notes. Let us know. We'll refine for the next one. And until then, you know, we'll chat to you in about a week's time.
Bye, everybody.
All right, guys. Catch you later.